And I'm talking now to Lily Barto from Frontline Action on Coal. G'day, Lily.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thank you for taking time. Now, of course, we know that Frontline Action on Coal has brushed right up against this particular issue, especially after the successful stopping of the ports in Newcastle. Tell us about what's going on for you guys.
Well, Frontline Action on Coal is a little bit dormant at the moment because it's kind of wrapped up and in Queensland there, and will no doubt reemerge somewhere else. But yeah, we definitely did come up against the pointy end of some of these repressive legislative changes that were pretty squarely designed to, you know, target activists, and they were pretty much made in response to the success of community-led campaigns against mining projects, yeah.
Yeah, it was the success that really galled them, right?
Oh, definitely. You know, like they wouldn't... It's quite a process, you know, to introduce a new law. And it's not easy to pass a law in this country, but if it's to protect the interests and the power of the wealthy, then, you know, the parties seem to be able to put their differences aside and, you know, get that passed right on through.
The sweetener for the public, that it's all about reducing inconvenience to people and demonising climate activists.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think there's three things that the media and the politicians, but with the acquiescence of mainstream media, have done very successfully. And one of those is to conflate inconvenience with violence. So they've done a very good job of talking about disruption or inconvenience or something that, you know, just causes a bit of a kerfuffle with violence and terrorism. And that's straight out of, you know, the post 9/11 playbook of, like, if you call whatever it is you don't like terrorism, then you can do basically anything to combat it. Another thing that they've managed to do that I think is quite an interesting little inversion is that they've mischaracterized disruptive active protest and subversion as being like an attack on a city and its people, when grassroots activism is necessarily done by the people, right? Like,
which is actually exactly the same tactic employed against unions.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And they talk about it like it's an attack on a population, when, you know, the message that the activists are sending, that represents a current of thought that is alive and constantly evolving inside a population. So it's not, that doesn't make sense to, you know, characterize it as like an attack on Sydney or something like that.
And what was the third thing that they've done?
Oh, and then the third one that they really like to do is they like to shift the terms of the debate. And the reason that they do that is they want to avoid talking about why people protest. So I'm really grateful to be on this show because activists are rarely afforded the opportunity to speak for themselves in the media. The media generally tend to go to other people for comment, but not the activists themselves. And when the journalists do question the activists directly, usually their questions are about their choice of tactic rather than what they were actually demanding or what they were opposing.
Yeah.
So they'll ask questions like, you know, do you think it's fair and valid for you to be allowed to disrupt traffic because of your agenda or something like that, you know? Because what they don't want to talk about is, what were you asking for? Because what they were asking for was really reasonable and most people would agree with it, right? So that's absolutely not what they want to have the conversation about. They want to shift the terms of debate to talk about, like, the validity of the tactic that was employed as opposed to the message that they were actually trying to send.
Do you think that, just as a matter of interest, that there is a generational change, that in actual fact it's gone much further than the white men in suits and their enablers, to the point that this issue of climate and the future for a younger generation just trumps all this, you know, smoke and mirrors that's being produced by the legal system and the mainstream media?
I think so, in the sense that, you know, support for stronger climate action is obviously, like, higher. It's extremely high in the age group of, you know, like 18 to 40-year-olds and stuff. But I think there's also, you know, the climate movement is also full of older people who don't buy it either.
Yeah. That's so,
you
right.
know, and you know, shout outs to them. I want to acknowledge them too, because you know, like, older people are a really important and beautiful section of our movement, and you know, that's, you know, who we look to for guidance, and they're often the people who are, you know, showing up to support people at court and stuff like that. So, you know, like, I think, yeah, definitely there is a generational change happening in the broader population around the way that people perceive the urgency of the ecological crisis that we're facing. But, yeah, definitely still want to give shout-outs to, you know, people like the Knitting Nanas and, you know, Grandparents for Climate Action and, you know, all of those people who are, you know, putting really good work in and you know, showing up for people.
Do you think that the experiences that you guys are having with the police, it's hard to describe to people what it's like to be at the pointy end of a police attack, and that the pajama brigade, you know, the ones that go around, like the critical response team and all the other stuff that happens, you know, where people are, at one moment you're a citizen and the next minute you're just fair game.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to describe this. So it's absolutely essential that people stand outside court for people like Violet Coco and for the activists who were gathered up during the campaign in Newcastle coal terminal. Because, you've got people, compatriots, who are in jail, right?
Not currently.
Oh, good.
I do have, yeah, thankfully. So, a couple of young fellows called Max and Tim spent 3 weeks in custody earlier this year after they were refused bail, which is really unheard of for a nonviolent offence. Like, it's actually very rare for people to be refused bail. So just for listeners who maybe don't know what that means you'll be arrested, you're taken into custody, and then you're given a court date, and it's usually in like 2 or 3 weeks. And then between your arrest and your court date, if you're let out of custody, then you're on bail, is the terminology. That's like what it's called. Or you can be held in remand. So that's what it means when they refuse you bail and they keep you in custody until you've gone through your court case. So at the point where you're on bail or not, you've been refused bail, you haven't even been found guilty yet. You've just been charged, right? The court has not even determined whether or not you're guilty, which is why it's fairly rare for people to be held in remand. And the only reason that the legal system sort of permits for you to do that is if you present a danger to the community, which cannot be managed by putting conditions on your bail. So you can have conditions on your bail that might be things like, say, if you were arrested protesting at a coal port, you might not be allowed within 2 kilometres of a coal port. We see it a lot that if you were arrested with somebody else or with a number of other people, they might say you're not allowed to communicate with those other people. That's called a non-association order. And yeah, there've been also, like, I just want to touch on bail as a nexus of sort of where the police are majorly overstepping their power, because I think it is a part of the story that's really not getting a lot of airtime. Obviously, we're also seeing really draconian, authoritarian anti-protest legislation being passed, but bail is an area where police have a huge amount of discretion to essentially just make up bail conditions. And the Bail Act, as it is, pretty specifically and explicitly states that they're not supposed to be punishments, because it's not the police's job to punish you under the legal system, right? The separation of powers, all of that, it is the court's job to determine what an appropriate punishment is, not the police. Yes. But what they've worked out they can do is they can use them to punish people by curtailing their liberties really, really severely while they're on bail, and then drag out their court case, so you might be on bail for, because, you know, also the local court system is so horrendously, you know, like underfunded, and all the, you know, so it takes months and months sometimes to get your day in court.
Yep.
And the police can also just turn up and go, oh, we're not ready, we need to adjourn. And then they just get another date in a couple of weeks. And, you know, and that's like frowned upon if you do it a whole bunch of times in a row by the court. But we do see police prosecutors doing it quite a bit.
So this is just an on. I mean, I did think this through too. This curtailing of people's personal freedom and association. It's yeah. But what they're doing is putting your lives in the hands of the police.
Well, yeah, and they're using what they've figured out they can do. I think is they can disrupt the organizing itself through the use of things like non-association conditions, through saying, you know, you have to report every so often, like it might be weekly. Some people have had it every day.
Yeah.
They have to go and report to their local cop shop. Mm. And some people currently are on bail in New South Wales who have been told they cannot use end-to-end encrypted messaging apps. So they're not allowed to use WhatsApp, they're not allowed to use Signal, Wire, like any of those communication platforms.
Yep.
Yeah. And are just like unheard of. These incredibly like restrictive, insane bail conditions. And it's because the police can just sort of do that, and then you have to actually go to court to get them varied.
Yep.
So the other thing you can do is refuse to sign them while you're in custody, and then you're held overnight, and then you're slotted in to the next available, like, sort of slot in court the next day, and you go before a magistrate, and you can
argue your point.
Can challenge the bail conditions that the police have tried to impose on you there,
yeah,
and then the magistrate can either change them, uphold them and leave them as they are, or throw them out entirely.
Yeah, but that means that you have to be aware of what's going on.
Exactly. You have to know that that option is available to you, and you also, it requires you to stay overnight in custody. And lots of activists do choose to do that, to challenge this kind of, like, punitive use of bail conditions. But, you know, a lot of people, if you're in custody and someone says, if you sign this piece of paper, you can go.
Yeah, yeah, it's frightening.
You're going to sign the piece of paper, right? Like,
yeah, yeah, it's frightening.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's frightening. You can see why. And it's terribly brave of people to stand up. But what's at stake is the world and the future.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we always say, or, you know, a lot of people from FLAC would often say when we would be questioned about the risks involved in protesting or whatever, the legal risk is like, well, you know, it's dwarfed by the risk of doing nothing.
Mm, yeah, it is. Yeah, and these time wasters with their money-grabbing focus is just so annoying.
You're telling me, yes. Yeah, and I mean, like, the hypocrisy of it is really laid bare when you look at what the companies tend to be fined and the consequences that the corporations face when they break the law. So, you know, all this law and order rhetoric, all this stuff about, you know, inconveniencing the public, all of that kind of stuff, you know, that just absolutely doesn't apply when it's the corporations who break the law. Like,
yeah,
you know, we've seen in, you know, many campaigns, we've seen activists be fined more than the company for breaching, you know, water standards, you know, polluting waterways, things like that, like breaching their environmental regulations or exploring without a unlicensed gas exploration, things like that, they get fined literally like less than the activists do.
Yeah, yeah. It's a real question of which side are you on, humanity or greed?
Absolutely. And I think they've made it pretty clear.
Yeah, well, the fight goes on. Is there anything else you want to say, Lily, that I've left out?
I suppose just one thing that I'd like to say is don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to participate in protests. So while, you know, we are trying to draw attention to this, like, creeping authoritarianism that is happening, you know, right under our noses, basically, we're strong enough together, like, we are stronger than their repression. And so I don't want anyone who's listening to be frightened away from protesting or from participating in democracy, as is your right. I want people to feel, you know, empowered to stand together, because that is the only thing that is going to roll back this trend.
Yeah, yeah, you're completely correct. Thank you very much for talking to us today, Lily.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that was Lily Bartow from, formerly from, well, it's in hiatus at the moment, Frontline Action on Coal, and talking about frontline experience of repression of climate activists. But the fight goes on.